Welcome to the UFO Files Show with your host, Jerry Pippin.
Well, Stanton Friedman, we appreciate you taking time to talk to us about this whole situation. One good thing, our hit count went up, your hit count went up, so all of it's not bad, even though you were called a book promoter.
Well, I was called a Roswell promoter and a UFO promoter about a myth, which I found extraordinarily reprehensible, frankly.
Yeah, that part just astounded me.
Well, you know, they even showed the cover of my book. Obviously, nobody read it. And I sent them 57 different tapes. They wanted stuff from which they could extract bits and pieces. So I'm a good guy. I sent them a bunch of them, including Recollections of Roswell, which has testimony from 27 firsthand witnesses. And it was as if all of this stuff and all my papers, which are noted, a number of them on my website, and it's as if it all didn't exist. You know, if they'd said researcher, okay, investigator, okay, they could have said nuclear physicist, but then that would have made my testimony worth listening to it, wouldn't it? And they were consistent. They had Jesse Marcel Jr. on. They never bothered to say that he was a medical doctor and a colonel in the military, now serving as a flight surgeon in Iraq. He's 67 years old. I mean, those two qualifications, it seemed to me, would lend credibility, wouldn't they? And so with me, the fact that I spent thousands of dollars of my own money long before there were ABC television cameras in sight, and thousands of hours of time locating people before the Internet, I've shown that some witnesses were phony. They used one of those, unfortunately, Frank Kaufman, on the show. It's as if truth didn't matter. They seem to have an agenda, is what I can say. And I probably can't sue them for slander, although I'd like to. I want a libel case in England, but English law and American law are not the same. But there seemed to be a real agenda in terms of, they threw out a lot of tidbits. The first part of the show was well done. And then they hit hard on the three areas that would turn your views around if you paid attention to the facts instead of the garbage they broadcast. Namely, one is Roswell. Clearly, if the United States government recovered a crash flying saucer and alien bodies, then the planet is being visited, and the government has known it for a long time, et cetera, et cetera. The implications are enormous. Clearly, if people, Earthlings, are being abducted by aliens, that's of great concern, too. The government isn't protecting us from being kidnapped, you know, all this kind of stuff. And the third thing is, the sort of the icing on the cake, clearly, if it is feasible to travel to the stars, then the biggest objection raised by the ancient academics and fossilized physicists that you can't get here from there would be demolished. So those are the three areas that they did their dirty work on. I mean, to have Bud Hopkins on is fine. I'm a great admirer of Bud. But to give the impression that all abductions are sleep paralysis related, when so many people have been abducted from their cars, you know, from out in the open, from a canoe out in the lake in Maine, etc., is, you know, that's not playing straight.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about it is they shot a lot of tape.
Oh, boy.
On a lot of people, and they didn't use any of it. I mean, like, you're talking about Bud Hopkins.
John Mack's tape was not used.
Right. They invested with these two psychiatrists, and one of them...
The psychologist, I think.
Psychologist, okay.
Yeah, they both were, you know, they didn't tell you how few abductees they had worked with. They didn't tell you that Dr. Clancy, the woman, said no evidence that hypnosis is a benefit in memory recall. Phil Klass tried that on me years ago, and I dug a book out of the library in which they related a number of instances. The one that really got to me, and I sent to him, and then he shut up, was a stonemason that was hypnotized and asked to describe the third stone from the right on the fifth row up, you know, of a whole structure that he had created. And he was able to describe the little details on it because he could regress them to when he was doing the work. It was like he was looking at it. Ask police departments around the country where you can retrieve license plate numbers that we don't pay attention to when our buddy who's been shot is bleeding to death alongside us, you know. Rape victims, when you have them replay the scene on the screen. Oh, sure, you can't use that in court, but it tells you who the person was. It gets you the car, you know, from the guys who shot the cop. When you find the bullet holes, then you know you got the right guy.
That's right. It's used routinely. In fact, they made it another assault on visual, you know, seeing is believing, and they basically had a guy on there that said, hey, you can't trust what you see.
Well, yeah, you know, that was one of the stupidest things, and it tells you something about astronomers. Astronomers, they have the only democratic science. The big shots get together, vote on truth, woe be unto he who disagrees, there's no place to publish. And then they have a new election 10, 20 years later. They've been consistently wrong about the size of the universe, the age of the universe, the processes that produce the energy in the stars, and particularly about flight, because they're willing to speak out about stuff about which they know nothing, zilch. And, you know, the three examples I frequently use in my lecture, here's what the astronomers, what a track record they have. Here's what they've had to say about flight. 1903, October, Dr. Simon Newcomb, one of the great astronomers of the 19th century, published a scientific paper in which he showed that the only way man would ever fly would be with the help of a balloon. This is 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. And when he was told about that, he said, well, maybe a pilot, but they certainly never carry any passengers. What did he know about aeronautics? Nothing. 20 years later, Dr. Bickerton proved that people had been talking back then, this is in the 20s now, about putting things in orbit around the Earth. Tsiolkovsky and other, far-sighted researchers. So he set out to prove that that would be impossible. He said, look, here's the maximum energy per pound of our best explosives. Here's the amount of energy per pound that you need to fly at 17,500 miles an hour in orbit. That number is 10 times the other number, so obviously we'll never be able to do it. Now, he made two stupid assumptions, stupid from the point of view of people who know anything about rocketry. One was that explosives have the most energy per pound. It's a little awkward to use, you understand, but when you can react together, say, hydrogen and oxygen, and, you know, and you get a lot more energy per pound. And much more importantly, he assumed that you were trying to put the propellant into orbit. What he had really shown was that it takes 10 pounds of propellant to put a pound of payload into orbit. That's what matters. But my favorite, Dr. Campbell, he's a Canadian, and, as I've pointed out to people, both Peter Jennings and I are dual citizens of the United States and Canada.
Weren't you born on the same day?
We were both born on July 29th. So I'm almost insulted to have somebody who shares my birth date do such a rotten job. And then as I pointed out to people, well, Benito Mussolini was also born July 29th. But Dr. Campbell, again, was an astronomer. In 1941, you may not be old enough to remember, there are a lot of pulp stories about space travel, going to the moon and all this stuff. And he, as a good scientist, was fed up with this science fiction garbage. And he published a scientific paper in which he set out to calculate an important quantity. He wanted to know what would be the required initial launch weight of a rocket able to get a man to the moon and back. How big does the darn thing have to be? That's a legitimate question. So pages of equations, bottom line, it would have to weigh a million tons. Even for me, that's too darn big. Less than 30 years later, we get three guys to the moon and back, still with the dumb old chemical rocket, whose initial launch weight was all of 3,000 tons. He was off by a factor of 300 million. I mean, you know, this isn't a factor of two. We're talking 300 million. Why? Was he a stupid man? No, he was just totally ignorant about the science and engineering world. for example, he assumed a single-stage rocket. He assumed to launch straight up instead of to the east to get a little cosmic freeloading. He assumed too low an exhaust velocity. He assumed a limit of 1G acceleration, but the faster you get to orbit, the less energy it takes. He assumed that when you came back, you'd have to slow down. You're going 25,000 miles an hour, pretty good idea to slow down before you land, but the only way you can do that was with a retro rocket. But every pound of fuel propellant that you use at the end, that'd be launched from the Earth at the beginning, slow down at the moon, launch from there, slow down back here. And he also assumed that the rocket had to provide all the energy. Any smart space scientist knows we use cosmic freeloading. When we go to the moon, we shoot the rocket up into the sky. If the moon didn't happen to come along at just the right time, it would come right back to Earth. We use the moon's gravitational field, and you know what? We don't need to put it there. All our deep space probes, the Cassini spacecraft, which is out there at Saturn, that put down this Huygens probe on Titan, we sent it out inward past Venus, came back past the Earth, got free kicks at each one, went past Jupiter, got a free kick there, and then on to Saturn. And, you know, smart guys try to figure out how to do things rather than how not to. And, of course, coming back, we don't use a retro rocket. We use the Earth's atmosphere. It's a freebie. Remember Apollo 13?
Sure.
You better get the angle right or you're going to be gone. Either dig a hole in the ground or bye-bye Earth. But if you're smart rather than powerful, you can accomplish a very great deal. Now, the SETI was really infuriating to me. I was the only one on the program, as far as I know, who's ever worked on advanced propulsion systems.
You have quite a history there with Westinghouse and
General Electric and General Motors and Aerojet General and McDonnell Douglas and TRW Systems. I set a record for working on canceled government-sponsored advanced research and development programs, but it was particularly infuriating, having worked on, say, nuclear fusion, which allows you to kick particles out the back end that have 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. 10 million. To have them use as an example of the impossibility of deep space travel, the Voyager spacecraft, which will take, gee whiz, 73,000 years to get to the next nearest star. The number is correct, but it's totally irrelevant. That's like saying, I'm going to throw this bottle into the ocean, and that'll tell me how long it takes to get to the other side. It hasn't had a propulsion system as part of its system since it left the vicinity of the Earth. I mean, it's coasting.
Yes.
And so to call it some indicator of how long it takes is absurd. Then they went on to compound things by saying, the fastest man-made object, 11 miles a second, and the speed of light is 186,000 miles a second. Oh, dear. What do you think we build accelerators for? We produce particles that are going at 99.999% of the speed of light in a nice vacuum chamber. Space is a lovely vacuum chamber. You book an accelerator, you know, on the back of the rocket, and away you go. The fusion particles go at extraordinary velocities. So, you know, it was totally misleading. And they could have shown footage of a nuclear rocket engine, the biggest one operated by Los Alamos, less than 7 feet in diameter. 4,400 megawatts, that's twice the power of Grand Coulee Dam. They didn't show that, you know. So it was loaded really badly. Now,
go ahead.
Now, just the other thing that really bugged me is they kept talking about lights in the sky and no physical evidence. I don't know how many times they said that. In the first place, most ufologists aren't concerned about lights in the sky. In the second place, Ted Phillips alone has collected more than 3,000 physical trace cases from 90 countries. These are cases where people see the saucer on or near the ground, and after it leaves, one finds the equivalent of burn circles, burn rings, landing gear marks, About 15% of those cases involve reports of small humanoid beings. No physical evidence, and the same went into, incidentally, back to Bud Hopkins for a minute. But it stressed to them, the scoop marks that you find in so many people, these are physical evidence. He also stressed multiple abductees. How do multiple abductees at the same time, in other words, taken together, suffer from sleep paralysis? Is this a contagious disease? You know, it's absurd to leave that out when I know that he stressed it.
Oh, I know. It's just amazing.
Talk about selective choice of data, propaganda. Wow.
I'm kind of interested in. I was on Roswell when they were there, the crew, the unit that interviewed you.
They spent over an hour with me. They spent over an hour with Don Schmidt. They went out to the crash site, which was set up with these little flags to mark off locations for digging, looking for any pieces of wreckage or stuff. And they show you this barren field.
In fact, I have heard that they just really weren't very interested in real evidence at Roswell. They wanted to shoot more of the celebrations, the observations, the...
Why did they use 1997 stuff, for goodness sake?
Well, that's one of the big riddles of the show. The first hour was pretty good, and as you're quoted in your piece, you said the show was like a horror film as far as the second hour.
Yeah.
And to me, it was... I love that description, by the way, Stanton, but to me, the second hour seemed like it was put together at the last minute.
Yeah.
Somebody changed their mind, or somebody put some pressure on somebody.
Yeah, you can't possibly show that stuff. That would lead people to believe that SETI is silly and that aliens are real. Come on. I found out just last night, as a matter of fact, after I wrote my piece for the MUFON Journal, that another pair of people that they wound up on the cutting room floor, was Ted Rowe of NARCAP, the National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, something like that, pilot sightings, if you will, and Dr. Richard Haynes, who Dick has collected. He's in my 1979 movie, UFOs Are Real, and at that time he had over 3,000 pilot sightings. He was a NASA scientist. And they talked to both of them, and they didn't use any of that material. Instead, they had these city cultists, as I call them.
Well, yeah, they had Jill Carter on there, talking about pilots, and she was talking about seeing...
the moon!
Yeah, right.
That tells you something about the observational skills of astronomers.
Yeah.
That was one of the most extraordinary moments of the film. They made a big deal about she and her husband in a small plane were fooled for a moment by the moon, which had clouds in front of it. And weren't they smart to figure out that's what it was? I mean, how extraordinary. And they talk about, you talk about me being a promoter. And I readily admit, of course, I've been promoting Roswell based on thousands of hours and thousands of dollars worth of effort and 27 years of study on the darn thing. And talk about promotion. The gleam, SETI became a religion on that program. We have the high priests telling us how important it will be for mankind. They can just see it now when that magic moment occurs when they pick up a signal. And then they were mistaken about, they said the noise of an airplane going over for Frank Drake's Wow. And I have a little trouble with that. Do they really mean noise or is the electromagnetic signal? I didn't know radio telescope could pick up sound waves, you know?
I that kind of stood out with me, too. You know the field well enough. I don't. And
well,
I thought,
the fact that they had them, how many times did you repeat that? it was truly mind-boggling. And you see, the problem you get into here is a great phrase by Beatrix Gazzo Rivera, I don't have her name quite right, out of Europe, woman physicist. These guys think of themselves as the crown of creation. We will pick up signals because nobody's much more advanced than we are, and of course they're trying to attract our attention, and we're the equivalent of any. We're one of the smart guys. I mean, they've estimated, I call it dartboard physics, how many stars, how many planets are there now that have civilizations capable of sending and receiving radio signals? And the numbers, oh, 20,000, 30,000. Got 200 million stars in the galaxy. Hey, we're one of them. That makes us super special. But in reality, as Dr. Rivera points out, it's much more like we're the baboons in a nature preserve in the jungle. I have no idea what's going on outside us. And as I try to point out to people, if you think, sit back a little bit and say, how long have we had sophisticated technology? The number I'd use is about 100 years. Radio waves, airplanes, you know, rockets, atoms. There's a whole bunch of technology that really came into its own within the past 100 years. But, gee, Zeta Reticuli out there, Zeta 1 and 2, only 39 light years away, which is just down the street. They're a billion years older than the sun, for goodness sakes. And if they're only 100 years older, I mean, I was embarrassed. I was at a college in Detroit. I was talking about progress comes from doing things differently, and the future, you know, is not an extrapolation of the past. And I mentioned, gee, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule. And I looked around the class, and it was perfectly obvious that none of the students, and I asked, and it was true, none of the students knew what a slide rule was, and that's less than 50 years ago. So what will somebody who's 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 or 1,000,000,000 years ahead of us, you know, their technology is not going to be like ours. Look at the computer on my desk here. What would that have been worth 50 years ago?
Yeah, good points. And the thing, you know, I still don't understand, and maybe somebody will give us a clue sometime from inside ABC or something, why they felt they needed to use the term myth. I mean, they used it twice, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It came off as it was maybe making fun of the UFO people. But I think there was something else going on. He gets a lot of money from ABC, and he probably has another project like well, I want to do this special. You know, he did that Christianity special.
Which I like.
Yeah. And he's probably got another pet project he wants to do. And he says, well, you know, he probably, well, what the heck. I'll go ahead and do this. And so, I mean, I think there was a lot of...
he was paying his dues, huh?
Yeah. I think there was a lot of things going on that he didn't have anything to say about.
You're probably right. Hey, let me give out my website.
I want to do that again, because and I want to talk of, basically, they can order anything from that website, and you've got lots of material, and maybe they'll look at the videos.
Yeah, there are some good ones out there, Recollections of Roswell.
Right, even though ABC didn't, evidently.
Yeah, but I used a piece from it, a little piece, I think. Not anything useful, but my website is www.stantonfriedman.com. And I've got a challenge to the SETI specialist, which is particularly appropriate for you with the program, and a number of other things on there. And I think people will find that there is stuff they can learn. There's an awful lot of data out there that especially young people aren't aware of. And, you know, I'm going to be speaking at a Fort Myers, South Florida, Southwestern Florida Museum. They, would you believe, have an exhibit based on Roswell.
Huh.
And they're bringing me in to speak there April 9th, I think it is, a Saturday. And they've been swamped with people wanting to sign up for the seminars I'm giving and stuff like that. They're really surprised. They're pleased. But, you know, I wish they'd do it in the middle of winter if you're going to go to Florida. It ought to be when it's warm. It's down there and cold up here.
Yeah, I understand. You know, that's one of the, you got more hits on your website. We've got more business. Here, this museum, you know, the thing that's happening, and it's well-founded, I think, because you know the UFO business, and you know what ABC did.
Yeah.
You know how the media covered it. Well, they probably cover everything that way. They go to experts. yeah, they go to experts, and they buy into whomever for whatever reason, and that's the attack they take. And so it just scares the hell out of me that our media is not giving the story on anything.
Yeah,
correctly.
I mean, when I see stuff, I was in the nuclear business a long time, and some of the stuff I see in the press, I say, look, this is something I know a great deal about. And they got it all wrong. How many other areas that I don't know much about?
That's the whole point. And so I think the positive side of this whole two-hour show was that it did probably capture some new people that weren't that are now interested in UFOs. And even though there's something to be said about them building you up and then letting you down and knocking your legs out from under it on the last hour, I don't necessarily think that works.
I don't think the public is as stupid as they think.
That's what I'm talking about.
You're right. And I
have a prediction that this year's Roswell celebration will be bigger than ever.
You're probably right. I hope so. I like going down to Roswell. I like talking to the people there. It's a nice town. For people who've never been there, there's no admission charge to the museum. People don't raise their prices in town for anniversary week. You get to meet a lot of nice people, and they've had people there from all over the world. 1.7 million visitors so far. And as you know, Roswell isn't close to anything. If you're there, it's because you want to be there.
Yeah, you gotta want to be there. That's right.
It's 200 miles from Albuquerque, 200 miles from Amarillo, and 200 miles from El Paso. So if you can get 1.7 million visitors down there in less than 10 years, that tells you a lot, I think. And, you know, I've been out on the hustings, over 750 lectures, and I've had 11 hecklers, two of whom were drunk. Now, I come on very strong, as you know. I'm not an apologist ufologist. And that tells you a great deal about how the world responds to facts, data, solid information. And I have an open question and answer period. Whatever hand goes up, there's none of this written questions and only answer the ones that I like kind of thing. And so I've been out there. And I know that most people are perfectly well able to reason if you give them the facts and the data. They're a little rusty, too much advertising out there. But you raise the objections and then demolish them, and they understand.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time. You're going to be April 9th down in Florida?
Yes.
And then at the X Conference?
Yeah.
And
going to be in Roswell on the, it's the first weekend in July.
Yeah, and we'll be down there and we'll see you there.
Okay.
That's for sure. And I was thinking last night, they ought to have somebody dressed up like Peter Jennings to begin the parade, but he's liable to get stoned.
Great idea.
Yeah.
I'll suggest it.
Okay.
Thanks much.
Okay, we'll talk to you later, Stan.
Okay. Bye.